Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadelska. A lot has been going on in the state since our last episode, and we have you covered. It's been a year since a rural ranching community in Sublette County was cast into the international spotlight after one man's treatment of a wolf.
Don't drag a dying animal around. Like, what? Like, that's some sick stuff.
Federal funding freezes and layoffs have had real impacts on our state. We hear from two people who were fired from the research arm of the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
All my projects revolved around helping smaller farmers deal with the impacts of drought in this region, and all of those projects have been canceled.
And the 68th Wyoming Legislature has gaveled out. Cheyenne Roundup fills us in on the end. Those stories and more on Open Spaces. Stay with us.
Sometimes the news can be a little hard, but Around Wyoming is here to bring you the lighter side of things. Ever heard of frozen chicken curling? Or do you know how many of our residents compete in and win national competitions? Hint, it's a lot. Around Wyoming brings you that and more four times every weekday. You can also find Around Wyoming on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we cut through the distracting clutter in the week's news and get to what really matters.
It's sweet, but can we talk about the nipple rings?
I'm Peter Sagal. Join us as we take the shirt off the news and see what's under there every week on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturday morning at 10 and Sunday afternoon at 4 on Wyoming Public Radio.
Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Camila Kadelska. Today, we're going to hear from several different federal employees who've lost their jobs as the Trump administration slashes the federal workforce. But first, it's been a year since a rural ranching community in Sublette County was cast into the international spotlight because of outrage over what many deemed torture of a wolf. The legalities and culture around the incident are still hot-button issues. Wyoming Public Radio's Caitlin Tan brings this recap.
Let's rewind to February 29th last year. At the local watering hole in Daniel, Wyoming, people are chatting, drinking beers, and in walks a man and what he's calling a dog.
No, like, that's a wolf. Am I crazy or is that a wolf?
This Sublette County resident was there and snapped a video of Cody Roberts bringing in a live wolf, leashed, muzzled, and injured. It laid tied to a coat rack in the bar for hours.
They were like petting it and, you know, he like lifted it up and kissed it on the face.
The next day, she ran the video by Game and Fish.
I just wanted to know if it was what I was seeing was normal. And the resounding answer was no.
Roberts was fined the maximum amount for possession of live wildlife, $250. The video, and what many considered a measly fine, went viral. That's part of why we're granting the source anonymity.
It's actually not the people here that I care about knowing. I'm honestly worried about the keyboard warriors who dig into your life.
Really sad story that came out of Wyoming this weekend.
Daniel, Wyoming, of course, if you haven't heard.
A huge, huge culture of wolf hatred.
And it's terrible laws that allow
this is an abomination, and this is
calling for Wyoming boycott and other people.
Thousands of angry calls from across the globe flooded the local sheriff's office. Vulgar death threats made to locals who had nothing to do with it. Wyoming Office of Tourism, social media, and ads went dark for about a month, inundated with horrified comments. Then there was a brigade of wolf advocates that drove through Daniel, where locals met them. Much of the town rallied around one of their own. Both sides dug in. And then the political response came.
Thank you all for being here both in person.
Democratic Jackson online. Representative Liz Storer led a work group of stakeholders over the summer. They combed through potential changes to Wyoming's predator laws, but it was tangled. Here's former Senator Fred Baldwin of Kemmer.
And what could we have had on the books in the statutes that would have changed the behavior of this individual? And I honestly am not sure that there's anything.
Workgroup member Jesse Johnson pushed back.
What was the real problem here? And it was that the animal didn't die quickly.
After months of back and forth, lawmakers landed on upping penalties for cruelty to animals. Had this law been in place when Roberts walked into that bar, he could have been fined up to $5,000 and potentially lost his hunting license. But many wanted it to go further.
That issue has given my community a black eye, my county and this state a black eye. This isn't going to go away.
Sublette County Representative Mike Schmid wanted to ban the sport of running over wildlife on public land.
It stops this senseless activity of just using a machine to whack an animal and torture it.
That bill failed. In the midst of all this, there's still an active investigation in Sublette County, even though Cody Roberts already paid his game and fish fine.
It's odd to keep a case open this long.
University of Wyoming's associate law professor Meredith Esser.
My guess is that it's remained open is more to sort of placate the media and animal lovers and wildlife enthusiasts who are maybe disappointed in the outcome.
The case could remain open forever. That's allowed for criminal cases in Wyoming. Sublette County Attorney Clayton Milinkovich says he still gets concerned emails about the issue. He didn't comment on why the case remains open. And for the anonymous woman who captured the infamous night on video, it's still an open wound.
I genuinely feel bad that they were harassed by the whole world. Like, his entire family, the entire town, the county.
But she stands by what she did.
It's not about never kill an animal. It's not about don't eat meat or take their guns. No, it's not about any of that. But just don't drag a dying animal around. Like, what? That's some sick stuff.
So where do things go from here? Another wolf advocate brigade is planned for June. And a bill in Congress would outlaw running over wolves with a snowmobile on public lands nationwide, but it's seen little movement. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Caitlin Tan in Daniel.
A couple of things to note. The Roberts family didn't respond to request for comment. A foundation Liz Storer runs supports a grant to WPR. And a longer version of this story will be available on our Modern West podcast this spring. Hannah and Ryan were fired from their federal jobs with the Agricultural Research Service in the middle of February. That's an agency within the U.S. Department of Agriculture that works on scientific solutions to agricultural challenges. Hannah has a PhD in soil science from the University of Wyoming and started working with the agency in September. Ryan has a degree in civil engineering and started his job last spring. Ryan has a degree in civil engineering and started his job last spring. The two think about 10% of the people in their building were let go. The USDA didn't respond to a request for comment by deadline Friday morning. But Hannah and Ryan asked to only be identified by their first names for fear of future retribution for themselves and their coworkers. They talked about how cuts might impact their work and what they think is next for farms in the Cowboy State.
With the USDA, I worked with a group that did outreach, research coordination, and research synthesis. So what that looked like was I worked directly with a lot of farmers, visiting farms, going to meetings of farmers, and making sure that they had the most up-to-date research to inform their management decisions, and then also listening to what challenges they were facing, bringing those concerns back to the researchers.
My primary job duty was to investigate the environmental and economic impacts of government-funded farm management practices. Each year, $2 billion tax dollars are given to farmers and ranchers to do things such as improve water and air quality, conserve water, increase soil health, reduce erosion, and mitigate against extreme weather, while importantly having a neutral to positive effect on profit. My work was related to measuring the effect of those various farm management practices in the Front Range and the plains of eastern Colorado, Wyoming, and Nebraska, so that we essentially know which practices are most effective in this region.
Right as we were leaving, the office was forced to cancel all travel, and our researchers work on farms across this whole region in Colorado and Wyoming.
As far as I know, the project that I was working on has completely stalled.
All my projects revolved around helping smaller farmers deal with the impacts of drought in this region, and all of those projects have been canceled. Pretty much all of the smaller farms I work with in Wyoming rely on some form of government programs, often the Conservation Reserve Program or subsidized crop insurance. There's so many threats from extreme weather, especially things like drought and hail, that smaller farms really struggle to absorb those risks and rely on these government programs to stay in business. The administration, like part of Project 2025, does include goals to cancel the Conservation Reserve Program and to greatly reduce subsidized crop insurance. And with those programs potentially going away, I just see a lot of smaller farms going out of business and going bankrupt, especially in this region, because the larger private agricultural companies like Monsanto, Bayer, and some of these other big companies are really focused on these larger agricultural regions like Iowa and the Pacific Northwest, and are just not going to address the problems that these smaller farms face in Wyoming and eastern Colorado, where it's a harsh environment to be farming in the first place.
Losing out on, you know, say about 10% of the workforce is inevitably going to stall or cancel certain areas of research or certain vital services for the public. Whenever you let go of people, it directly means that less productivity is going to happen, less services and less research are going to be accomplished.
All of our termination letters cited our performance, ostensibly that we were fired due to poor performance, but in reality, like, none of our supervisors were even told about our firings, and we all had positive performance reviews. We've since received letters confirming that we had exemplary performance. But because of that poor performance, that stated reason, none of us are eligible for any severance.
We were told about a week, well, actually about 4 days before the terminations began, that local leadership was cautiously optimistic for the security of our jobs. There is absolutely no indication that this was coming. It was, you know, it feels like everyone was completely blindsided by this.
Ryan was trying to buy a house.
The day that I learned that I was getting fired, I was at a home inspection for the house that we were planning to close on in early March. So unfortunately, after some tears, we had to rescind our offer.
I got fired late Friday night. I had been at a conference speaking to farmers in Cheyenne, Wyoming on Tuesday and Wednesday. I was rushing to try to email people that I had been working with to let them know that if I didn't respond, that probably meant I had been locked out of all my accounts and fired.
I'm planning on getting involved in one of the major class action lawsuits. This will be the first time I've ever been involved in something like this. So it is a little bit scary. Most of us are recent college grads or postdocs. We don't have a lot of money saved up. The thought of how we're going to pay for this class action lawsuit, if ultimately it's unsuccessful, that's a question that's like looming in my mind right now.
I would just echo that. I'm looking into joining one of the class action lawsuits. I've never been involved with lawyers before or in any sort of lawsuit. So just trying to figure out how to navigate this while also, you know, starting to apply for jobs and figure out what are the next steps.
For me, I have absolutely no idea where my partner and I will wind up geographically. I don't have a good guess as to what sort of work I will be involved in after this. I think the most logical step as a civil engineer would be to move into the private consulting industry. But even that feels like a little bit of a stretch right now, because as we spend time combing through private consulting websites or websites like Indeed, it's becoming pretty clear that there are fewer jobs available right now than there were a few months ago or like a year ago.
With all of these cuts in federal funding, I don't know if we'll be able to stay in Wyoming. I really enjoyed this work. I found it to be really important and meaningful, and I want to keep working with farmers on the ground. I don't want to just go work for one of the big ag companies that's not doesn't always have farmers' best interests at heart. But Wyoming just doesn't have the best state support for agriculture either, in terms of groups that are actually giving support to farmers. And so with all this happening, I see us probably having to move out of Wyoming and, yeah, find somewhere where we can pursue the kind of work that we feel is meaningful and that we want to do.
This story was produced by Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Haberman, and on Wednesday, the USDA was ordered to temporarily reinstate about 6,000 employees on the grounds of illegal termination. As of Friday morning, Hannah and Ryan hadn't heard yet if they would be getting their jobs back. Small businesses in Wyoming have been impacted by the trimming of federal bureaucracy. We'll hear how in just a bit. This is Open Spaces.
Hey there, this is Caitlin Tan, Energy and Natural Resources reporter. The Trump administration is taking action to reduce the size of the federal government and the workforce, and we want to hear from you if you work for or with the federal government. Let us know how these changes are affecting you. You can fill out an anonymous form on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org, so we can get a clearer picture of what's going on. Thank you.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. The Trump administration's cuts have ripple effects, from ending some workers' housing to an Endangered Species Act success story to small businesses and research. Federal agencies are putting millions of dollars towards scientific research in our region, but some small biotech businesses have been frustrated by the firings of the federal workers who cut the checks that keep them going. Wyoming Public Radio's Hannah Mersbach has more.
Ben Noreen swipes his key card to enter his window-filled lab at the University of Wyoming.
When you walk into the laboratory, there's many tiny syringes, vials.
Noreen's company, CellDrop, is trying to heal tendon and ligament injuries with stem cells in microscopic droplets.
These are about the width of a human hair, and we can then put them into any sort of tissue to help it heal faster and more effectively.
The eager 30-something with blonde shoulder-length ringlets says the goal is eventually to help humans. But the plan is first to roll out the product for injured performance horses, which sometimes have to retire early because of ligament injuries. Though the trials on that product have been put on hold.
Kind of our worst fears came true.
He thought it was largely research related to climate change or diversity that would be impacted by the tsunami of Trump cuts. But his company depends on National Science Foundation funding, and he hasn't been able to access it as anticipated. That's since the person who administers those hundreds of thousands of dollars was recently fired.
Running a technical small business is a pretty time-consuming task, and every time a new hurdle is added, it's just kind of like, oh my God, not more things to deal with.
About 10% of the federal agency's staff was let go, making it tough for Noreen to pay contractors. And he's not alone. Grantees who get money from many federal agencies are missing payments and cutting programs. In some cases, there have been reversals where funding and jobs are restored, including potentially in Noreen's case. But small businesses are especially vulnerable to such whiplash, says University of Denver finance professor Matt Klaus. Federal grants play an important role in helping startups get through what's known as the Valley of Death.
They're too small for a bank to be interested in, and venture capital doesn't want to look at you until they can invest somewhere around $1 million.
The NSF is currently putting about $1 billion towards researchers in the Mountain West, and millions more are coming from other agencies. The small businesses they fund help to diversify rural economies, including in Wyoming, which has made that its goal.
The state has to be more concerned and more aware of how important the small businesses are to the state economy.
Christoph Geisler runs a company developing new probiotics to help prevent kidney stone reoccurrences. It's backed by the National Institutes of Health, which has also seen cuts.
How do I tell my investors what situation I am in? Should I tell them the sky's falling when I may be okay? Or should I tell them that I'm okay when things can change, turn on a dime? I don't really know how to proceed with this.
He's so frustrated that he says he won't apply for federal funding again until there's more certainty. Ben Noreen, back at the stem cell lab, questions the newly created Federal Department of Government Efficiency, which is behind a lot of these cuts.
It certainly doesn't improve efficiency in my mind, because now all of the grants are being administered much more slowly than they were before.
A judge has now ordered about half of the NSF workers be reinstated, including the person Noreen works with. An agency spokesperson said this means the U.S. will remain a global leader in scientific discovery and innovation. But Noreen isn't so sure. This weeks-long hiccup has left him uneasy about the future as more cuts remain on the table. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Hannah Merzbach.
Some federal employees aren't just losing their jobs. They're losing their housing, too. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards caught up with a few.
Out on the snowy prairie near Pinedale, Samantha Marks gives a Zoom tour of the log barn she built herself last summer. There's a sleeping loft, a wood stove, and big views of the Wind Rivers.
My wonderful boyfriend is helping me move all of my stuff into the barn because with the federal employee thing, I was living in federal housing, so don't have that very much longer.
Her boyfriend carts stuff in on his mountain bike because her driveway isn't plowed. Outside the wide double barn doors, he piles up camping gear and pots and pans. Marks got laid off as a probationary physical science technician from the Bridger-Teton National Forest. Now, she only has a few days left to get moved out of employee housing. Mark says there's no way she can find an apartment in Pinedale. They go too fast. Plus, she says they cost around $2,000 a month. But she can't move into this barn either. It isn't heated or insulated.
And then I'll just be couch surfing until we can get the camper here.
Her plan is that when the snow melts, she'll pull a friend's camper out here and live in that until she can build a house. Mark thought she was being smart when she bought this land. She waited until the Forest Service offered her a permanent position.
On the paper, I did everything right. I don't know if I would have made the same choice.
Marks has decided to stay in Pinedale. This summer, though, she'll have to hustle to find work and build a house.
Pretty overwhelmed. Honestly, you know, I lost my job, my housing and health insurance all in one day.
These federal layoffs are hitting Wyoming in the middle of an affordable housing crisis. The state will be short as many as 38,000 homes by the end of this decade. And that much competition means that about 50,000 Wyomingites barely make enough to afford their rent or mortgage. That's according to a 2024 study by the Wyoming Community Development Authority. Chris Volsky is their deputy executive director.
And this is a hard statistic to even fathom, but it's real. So the median household income in Wyoming, which is a little over $70,000 a year, right, cannot afford the median priced house in every county in the state without being cost burdened.
That's when you have to pay more than a third of your income for your home. Volsky says their study shows that more Wyomingites are packing themselves into housing or even becoming unhoused.
The majority of homeless people in Wyoming are Wyomingites, but it's primarily our neighbors and people in our community that had a series of events that forced them out of their rental, into a car, into the street, whatever the scenario is.
One of those scenarios could be getting fired from a federal agency. Alan Willis and Terry Gilfillan are both in their 70s and live full-time in their RV. They talk on Zoom from their RV couch.
We're at a RV resort in Camp Verde.
Each winter, they lead tours and man a visitor center at Palatki Heritage Site. They get paid a stipend of $20 a day. But because of the federal funding freeze, they haven't gotten paid yet.
if we could get it without us costing an arm and a leg, it probably cost us $20,000 to go get $3,000. And that, we can't do that. They got us over a barrel.
Right now, they're paying $1,500 a month for a lot in an RV park.
Our next plan is waiting for the weather to break and go back up to Jackson, Wyoming, if we don't freeze ourselves, and wait till May is when the float trip season starts for me.
Every summer, Willis works as a shuttle driver for a rafting company. He's worried the drastic federal cuts will hurt business.
We're very nervous about that. If the Park Service closes down, I don't know if we'd be closed down. I would think so.
That would put their housing at risk since their company lets them park in a pasture for free.
Plan A, B, C, D. I don't think one plan cuts it.
One of those plans is getting off the road and settling down in Wyoming.
Never in my life would I have thought I would be living in an RV in the 70s. Yeah.
Coconino National Forest sent the couple an email the same day Wyoming Public Radio reached out for comment. It said they could expect their money within the week, but still, no check has arrived. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
Many Wyomingites know the success story of bringing black-footed ferrets back from the brink of extinction in Meteetse over 40 years ago, and many of the reintroduced populations have been released in the state. Now, one of the top federal biologists overseeing the work has been fired, part of a budget cutting from the Trump administration. For the Mountain West News Bureau, journalists Sam Brash and Arlo Perez Esquivel speak about the issue and the biologist.
Sam, can you tell us more about her?
Yeah, so this is Tina Jackson. Until recently, she oversaw the National Blackfooted Ferret Conservation Center outside Fort Collins. This is home to the world's largest captive population of these ferrets. But she took the job about a year ago, and newer employees have been targeted by President Trump's recent job cuts. So last month, she found out she and two other employees had been fired, and now she's worried about what that might mean for this whole ferret conservation effort.
It really sent the program spiraling because I was let go as well as two of our technicians that helped with the husbandry at the center.
Hmm. And just so we're all on the same page, what exactly is a black-footed ferret?
Jackson has described them as weasels with sort of a Wolverine attitude. They're small and long and skinny. I saw one of them described as tubes of muscle. So they might be cute, but turns out they're pretty vicious predators.
Oh, jeez. So why exactly do these tubes of muscle need Jackson's help?
Few species have come as close to annihilation as the black-footed ferret. They were living across the Western Plains in the 1800s, but by the 1970s, people thought this species was extinct. And then there was this sort of amazing story. A dog brought a ferret back to a ranch in Wyoming in 1981.
A dog?
Yeah, and it was the first sign that some of these ferrets might actually survive. They actually discovered the last remaining ferret colony there in southern Wyoming. And federal biologists then began this careful breeding program to build the species up and then reintroduce a few of those descendants all across the American West. But things are still pretty tenuous because biologists started with so few ferrets to begin with. They don't have a lot of genetics to work with, and that leaves them vulnerable to disease and other issues. That's why the breeding center actually worked with a nonprofit to clone a ferret back in 2020, and that marked the first time anyone has cloned an endangered species native to North America.
Wow. Okay, so within this context, you know, the head of the breeding center has been fired. What does she think will happen to the federal efforts to save the species?
So like I said, two of her staff are also let go. That leaves eight employees at this conservation center. The remaining employees have also had their spending restricted. Another Trump directive says federal employees can only spend $1 on their credit cards. Unless that changes, Jackson fears they're going to have a hard time buying food for the ferrets. Mm. And with the staff cut, she's already worried they're going to have a difficult time managing the upcoming breeding season.
That's in the breeding center. What about the ferrets already living in the wild?
So people who help the ferrets once they're introduced back in the wild also rely on federal staff and funding resources. Travis Laveri is one of those folks. He's out in South Dakota.
We've seen and read what the priorities of this administration are going to be, and it certainly does not seem to be, endangered species and conservation.
I think this gets to a really important point about species conservation. They're not like releasing ferrets and then letting nature take their course. People are heavily involved here. They're spraying prairie dog holes these ferrets live in with insecticides to protect these animals against the plague. If that stops, if the breeding slows down, Jackson told me the ferret population could plummet and decades of work could be erased.
The public hears all the time about how successful the ferret program is, but it is still on the brink, and things like this push it even closer to that edge.
Sam, thank you.
You're welcome.
That was Sam Brash from CPR News in Colorado talking with Arlo Perez Esquivel about federal efforts to save the black-footed ferret. The 68th Wyoming Legislature has adjourned. Up next, Cheyenne Roundup fills you in with the details you need to know. This is Open Spaces.
Hearing one story over and over again gets pretty old pretty fast. On Morning Edition, you'll hear all kinds of stories, from the big news to things that are just fun. Listen to Morning Edition every weekday from NPR News.
From 5 until 9 on Wyoming Public Radio.
My name is Conrad Smith. I grew up in Kansas, but I've lived in Laramie for 18 years now. I think that the primary function of public radio, at least in my opinion, is news and keeping public officials accountable. The entertainment is available many other places, but good quality news is not widely available, and I do believe Wyoming Public Radio has the best broadcast news in the United States right now. The service public radio provides is worth paying for, I guess, quite simply. Anybody who listens a lot has kind of a moral obligation to help pay the bills.
Begin or renew your membership on our secure website, wyomingpublicmedia.org. Click on the Pledge Now link. Thanks for your support.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Camila Gadelska. This winter, Wyoming Public Radio is teaming up with Wildfile to bring you weekly updates from the legislative session. It's called the Cheyenne Roundup, and you can hear it here in just a moment or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Cheyenne Roundup, a weekly look at Wyoming's legislative session from Wyoming Public Radio and Wyofile. I'm Chris Clements, Wyoming Public Radio's state government reporter, and with me is Maggie Mullen, Wyofile's state government and politics reporter.
Hey, Chris.
Hello. The legislature adjourned Thursday afternoon, Maggie.
The lawmakers have left the building, and so have we. We're recording Friday morning at 10 from our respective reporting nooks.
So we want to use this episode to come full circle and revisit something we talked about at the onset of the session, the interplay between the branches of government when it comes to lawmaking.
That's been on display this week as Governor Mark Gordon has signed, vetoed, and let bills become law without his signature.
And don't forget the judiciary.
Yeah, and the constitutionality of some of these measures has definitely been top of mind for Gordon, as we've seen in his letters explaining his decision-making on bills.
So let's start with abortion. With these bills, you really get to see the branches doing their thing. We both reported on these measures this week.
So far, Gordon signed one abortion bill and vetoed another. That veto was a bill to require patients seeking abortion medications to first undergo a transvaginal ultrasound and a 48-hour waiting period. While maintaining, in his words, a pro-life stance, Gordon said he objected to the bill's invasive nature and its lack of exceptions for victims of rape or incest. That's because a transvaginal ultrasound means using a wand-like device and inserting it into a woman's vagina to detect a fetal heartbeat. Gordon was also concerned, though, about the constitutionality of the bill. There's a lawsuit in front of the state Supreme Court about Wyoming's two near-total abortion bans passed in 2023. Gordon said passing new abortion laws before that ruling comes down invites more litigation.
And in fact, it already has.
Hours after Gordon signed a separate bill Thursday to enact several regulations on clinics that perform abortions, the state's one facility to do so, Casper's Wellspring Health Access, challenged the law in court. Wellspring aimed part of that complaint at the ultrasound regulation ahead of Gordon making a decision on it. Speaker of the House Chip Nyman, the bill's main sponsor, said the legislation was needed to keep patients safe while abortion remains legal.
And Maggie, just for a point of reference, the major complication rate for medication abortions is less than 1%. That's less than vasectomies.
But safety isn't Nyman's only objective.
If there's abortion that potentially could be prevented from this and a child's life could be saved, I guess I'd have to figure out what the downside of that is.
So Gordon vetoed the ultrasound bill, but the House and then the Senate voted to override it. Some senators, like Wendy Schuler from Evanston, voted for the bill originally, but then against the override.
Having taught for a lot of years, and I actually had a couple students in this situation, if they would have had to have gone through what we're asking them to do right now and be re-traumatized, re-victimized, I would feel really bad about that.
We've been here before. Gordon vetoed similar legislation last year on the grounds of ongoing litigation concerning Wyoming's two near-total abortion bans. He cited the same thing this year for the ultrasound bill.
But it's interesting to me that he let the clinic regulations slide this year, given that the constitutionality of prohibiting abortion is still stuck in the courts.
Another topic that's tangled up in the three branches is school funding and how that relates to charter schools.
Yeah, Gordon vetoed a bill that would remove the current limit of 3 charter schools in the state because he said this isn't the right moment financially. He cited a recent ruling from a Laramie County district judge who said the state is unconstitutionally underfunding public schools. Gordon said that without a plan, adding more charter schools into the mix is premature and unconstitutional.
But then the legislature voted to override that veto too.
And this year is what's called a recalibration year. Lawmakers are required to update the school funding model, so it'll be interesting to see what they do with the judge's ruling.
Speaking of complicated, let's talk about election-related bills. For starters, there were a lot of them, 45 to be exact.
So only 8 of those 45 bills made it through the legislative process to the governor's desk?
Yep. And the first to get his signature prohibits the distribution of unsolicited absentee ballot request forms. That bill stems from some mailers former Congresswoman Liz Cheney sent to voters in 2022 that had the appearance of being absentee ballot request forms. Gordon vetoed a similar bill in 2023 due to concerns over unintended consequences. At the time of recording, he's vetoed one election bill. That one would have put a minimum threshold on ballots cast in certain bond elections for the proposal to be approved. Gordon cited concerns over constitutionality, and ultimately the House sided with his veto Wednesday when it voted against overriding his decision. The rest of the bills on his desk involve voter registration, banning certain kinds of funding for elections, prohibiting ranked choice voting, and moving up deadlines for forming a new political party.
Of the election bills that passed, which is likely to have the biggest impact on voters when they go to cast their ballots in 2026, Maggie?
That would be House Bill 156. Under current regulations, Wyomingites are required to provide proof of identity when registering to vote. House Bill 156 would add proof of residency and citizenship to that process. It would also require residents to live in Wyoming for at least 30 days before casting a ballot. Opponents of the bill have said it risks disenfranchising eligible voters, such as unhoused residents, tribal members, and women staying at shelters to flee violence. Gray, however, called it a, quote, landmark election integrity bill and said it would make Wyoming the one state to require proof of citizenship to vote. Last year, Gray proposed via an executive rulemaking process, which is separate from the legislative process, requiring proof of residency during voter registration. Gordon, however, rejected the rules, citing a recommendation of the Legislative Service Office and Management Council.
Another area where the governor and legislature are zigging and zagging is DEI. And there's actually a pair of bills I've been reporting on that offer a good example of daylight between the House and Senate, too. So the House brought a bill that bars DEI hiring practices and initiatives in government and in education, but which didn't explicitly seek to outlaw DEI in classroom instruction. Instead, it said that no governmental entity can require instruction promoting what the bill calls institutional discrimination. Gordon signed this one on Tuesday, but then the Senate also had a DEI ban. It went a step further than the House's because it would have dictated what instructors could teach in the classroom. Gordon vetoed this one, saying the bill was ill-defined, created legal ambiguities, and risked unintended consequences.
Yeah, we've seen this a couple times where there's different vehicles for basically the same policy goal, and it's a duel to see which one wins out.
Right. I talked to a UW graduate student who was worried about both of them. Dylan Croft is a type 1 diabetic, and she's worried that programs that aren't federally protected, that are meant to help students with disabilities, are at stake. She listed things like
targeted assistance or like tutoring, financial aid even. There's been like there's scholarships that are specified for like diabetics and individuals with disabilities. So those could be cut potentially. I mean, we don't know exactly what this is going to look like.
And she says all of this is happening as places for diverse students, like the Multicultural Affairs Office, are being scaled back or eliminated due to the government crackdown.
I think it's just like feeling unwelcoming to some people. Like when I was a freshman here, I was on what's called the Spectrum Floor, which is like a queer community floor in Downey Hall. And so like those kind of safe spaces are going away.
Croft wasn't sure if the Spectrum Floor went away because of these political headwinds, but it's still one less place for diverse folks to hang out. The DEI ban goes into effect starting in July.
In our last couple minutes, I want to touch on another topic that had a number of bills on it, property taxes.
Yeah, the biggie bill was Senate File 69, which Gordon signed into law on Tuesday. Single-family homeowners will see the 25% cut applied to the first million of their home's fair market value. Lawmakers in the House and Senate heavily amended this bill, as we've talked about. In the end, they removed money to reimburse counties and towns for the property tax revenue they'll lose because of the new law.
That backfill, as it's referred to, was a priority for the Freedom Caucus. At the same time, they also said the 25% exemption won't be so bad for local governments since property taxes are only part of their revenue base. Other Republican lawmakers, particularly in the Senate, took a different approach to backfill. They said it wasn't a sustainable solution because it would lead local governments to be more dependent on state funding while also draining the state's savings. In the end, those lawmakers won out, and it's now up to local governments to figure things out.
I talked to Casper Mayor Ray Pacheco about that. He said the bill is short-sighted, but that he's glad the final version was only a 25% cut instead of 50%, as was proposed at one point. But he added it's going to affect some city services.
Our traditional conservative values is that we are fiscally responsible, fiscally conservative. And the idea that we have this vast amount of money to just spend into oblivion, to be able to do that, I don't think is fiduciary responsible.
He says the bill will likely result in Casper losing at least $1 million out of its $16 million savings. City staff will have to determine which services to cut or scale back in the coming month. And Pacheco says there's another issue going on regarding the bill.
Also, the communication between legislators and the cities and the municipalities were really no conversation at all.
So at this point, with lawmakers out of the building, the ball now rests in the governor's court.
And the court's court.
The governor's basically got 2 weeks to make decisions on the final pile of bills on his desk. Chris, what's left on your radar?
A lot. I'll be closely following the new abortion court case in Natrona County District Court after the bill regulating Wellspring was signed. I'll be gathering reactions to some of these bans on where trans folks can go in the state. Plus, I'm still waiting on bill signings. And you, Maggie?
Well, the session may be over, but the interim is just beginning. That's the off-season when lawmakers get a whole bunch of their work done, so I'll be paying attention to that before not too long. But I got a couple session deep dives in the works, plus another episode of this podcast.
Looking forward to it. So thanks for listening to the Cheyenne Roundup, your weekly look at what lawmakers are up to during the 2025 legislative session from Wyoming Public Radio and Wyofile. New episodes drop every Friday throughout the session. Editing and producing by Tennessee Watson and Nikki Ouellette. Follow our ongoing legislative coverage at wyomingpublicmedia.org and wyofile.com. And thanks again for listening.
The Cheyenne Roundup will be back next Friday, March 14th. Keep an eye on wyomingpublicmedia.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Up next, chronic wasting disease has been found in feed grounds. We check in with a Wyoming game and fish biologist to get a sense of what this means for the state's ungulate population. This is Open Spaces.
Who are we as Westerners exactly?
Horse hugs are the best hugs in the world because they're huge and they'll wrap their head around you.
Are we made of myths or something entirely new?
We're immigrants, so it's really hard for us, like, to trust.
8 seasons full of the stories of our evolving identity.
We can't and should not dismiss history, no matter how difficult it is.
The Modern West. Find it under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Wyoming Public Radio brings the news to you in our daily and weekly email newsletters. Sign up on our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. Since December, 2 elk feed grounds have had elk test positive for chronic wasting disease. According to game managers, the 100% fatal brain disease threatens the health of elk statewide, especially the thousands of them in 6 herds in the northwest part of the state that winter on feed grounds. Jackson Hole Community Radio's Dante Filpula Inkney spoke with Ben Wise, a state wildlife biologist who says the confirmed cases at the Dell Creek feed ground south of Jackson are concerning.
It's on the Hoback River. The Hoback River flows into the Snake just south of town. We know that there's animals that are using the Dell Creek feed ground that are, you know, sharing boundaries with elk from the Fall Creek elk herd and the Jackson elk herd. So it's close in proximity. It's much closer proximity wise than the CWD positive elk that we found at Scab Creek. So for my standpoint, being in the Jackson region and dealing with wildlife disease in the Jackson region, that is really concerning for me.
Why is it so concerning?
We had assumed that when we started detecting CWD in elk in western Wyoming, it would be pretty slow, kind of like what we've seen in other parts of the kind of the feed ground system. You know, we had an elk that tested positive in the Jackson elk herd in 2020, I believe, just north of the refuge in Grand Teton. This last year we had an elk in the Fall Creek elk herd that tested positive. We kind of assumed that was what it was going to be. It was going to be kind of like sporadically, we're going to find one elk, maybe two elk that were deceased, but we sampled and CWD was detected. Cause we kind of assumed that, like, oh, we're going to pick it up through a hunter harvested animal. That's where the majority of our samples come from. To have it pop up at Dell Creek in multiple animals in the same year, in a fairly short time span, we're kind of past that point at that particular feed ground. We're past that, like, slow build. We're, like, seeing the ramifications of having CWD in that population. We're finding dead animals with that are skinny, emaciated, and they're coming up positive.
Would you be willing to say that this CWD is encroaching on the Jackson elk herd?
It is. It's coming from all directions. We have deer coming out of kind of the Dubois area. They have a fairly high prevalence of CWD in a deer herd. We have high prevalence of deer in the Shoshone, like the South Fork of the Shoshone. They're all kind of coming intermingling with elk in the Jackson elk herd. That was always my concern, is like, we know that there's deer coming in. There's probably elk coming in as well that are at low levels of CWD prevalence, but they're mixing in. For us to find that many CWD-induced mortalities shows that that is a fairly big it's a concerning kind of realization that it's here and it's at a higher rate than we had anticipated it would be this early in the kind of the CWD feed ground kind of situation. We're fortunate on the refuge. We have a lot of elk on the refuge, but we also have a lot of space for elk on the refuge. And because of kind of the way that the refuge is situated, a lot of times they're able to delay the start of feeding later into the season and then also end feeding earlier. So like the way I look at this as a disease biologist is elk at high densities have a much higher transmission risk. So the amount of time that you can reduce the density, the better off you'll be, the less transmission risk you're going to have. So the refuge does a really good job of trying to spread elk out as much as they can when they're feeding. They have feeding seasons that allow them to have elk on feed for a fairly short period of time. Del Creek is kind of the opposite of that. Del Creek is a very, very snowy, very cold part of Wyoming. Snowpacks are just exceedingly deep there at times. There's also a really high risk of brucellosis transmission to neighboring livestock producers.
Yeah, Ben, that's all my questions, but I wonder if you have anything to add.
I think the best thing that we can give to people is that this, although it's very concerning, it's not totally a surprise that we're like starting to detect it on feed grounds, because we've been detecting it in elk off of feed grounds, you know, for the last several years. I think the most important thing to take away is that we do see that this is a very, very, very serious issue. And because of that, we as an agency have taken on the task of developing, they're called FMAPs, or their feed ground management action plans. So part of that planning process is garnering public support for management decisions we're making on feed grounds. Because we can't do anything as an agency. We work for the state of Wyoming. We work for the people of Wyoming. So if we don't have the support of the people of Wyoming, we can't really move forward.
That was Jackson Hole Community Radio's Dante Philpula Inkney talking with Ben Wise, a wildlife biologist with Wyoming Game and Fish, about recent confirmed cases of CWD in feed grounds. Last year, the agency finalized a plan to reduce elk's dependence on feed grounds. They're working on what that will look like for each herd. Despite the disease clock ticking, Game and Fish says no changes will happen fast, and it's unclear what exactly those changes will look like. Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. The entire show and all the stories you heard here can be found on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. It can also be found wherever you get your podcast, and we post all our stories on the station's social media platforms. Thanks to Ivy Engel, our audio and digital producer today, and Cody Hume, our social media manager. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.